Good afternoon and welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Tom Wheeler, Executive Director of the Environmental Protection Information Center. The Eco News Report is brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, Eco News. And we have a very special show today. I have two great guests coming by phone to talk about redwood restoration. So first off, we have Lathrop Leonard, a forester with State Parks based out of Crescent City. Hey, Lathrop.
How are you doing today?
Good. And Richard Campbell, Forestry Program Manager with Save the Redwoods League. Hey, Richard.
Hello, Tom.
All right. Well, welcome, gentlemen. So we're going to be talking about how logging can actually help restore forests, which is maybe something that is counterintuitive to people. And you guys both have great backgrounds. So let's hear about those backgrounds. So Lathrop, tell me, what's your job? How'd you end up there? And what do you do on a day-to-day basis?
So I am the forester for the North Coast Redwoods District of California State Parks, which is basically Humboldt County and Delmarte County and a little bit of Mendocino. And within that umbrella, I, among other things, I run the prescribed fire program as well as the forest restoration program. So we're reintroducing fire as an ecological process within the prairies and forests of our parks. And we're looking at forest restoration, especially within the cutover lands that we've acquired from timber companies over the years, and trying to get those forests on a trajectory that'll get them back to old-growth forests on their own.
All right. And Richard, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure, Tom. So I manage the forestry program for Save the Redwood League. What that means is I help the league identify where in the redwood landscape conservation is going to be most important and most effective, the types of tools we might use, the types of land protection tools or ecosystem restoration tools that we might use to meet those conservation goals.
Very cool. And because people might be asking, what is that wonderful accent of yours?
Well, I started off in Northern Ireland, but I've been in the U.S. for going on 25 years now, so it's probably a bit muddled.
Well, I love it. It's perfect for the radio. All right. So we're going to have a little bit of a contest here between the two of you. And this is the elevator pitch contest. So you just came out with this exciting new collaboration partnership between National Parks, State Parks, and Save the Redwoods League called Redwood Rising. And we'll get into what that is all about in a sec. And I'm sure you've had to describe this numerous times, what this is to people. So imagine that you are on an elevator, you're in San Francisco, you're about to go out to dinner with your wife or your sweetheart, and Governor Brown steps into the elevator with you, and he looks and he sees your name tag and he says, well, that's interesting. What are you working on today? So you have 30 seconds to describe Redwoods Rising to Governor Brown, and I'll have Richard, you go first, and I'm watching the clock, and it starts now.
Okay. Well, Redwoods Rising is a collaboration between Save the Redwoods League, California State Parks, and the National Park Service to restore the redwood forest ecosystem of Redwood National and State Parks. A lot of people don't know this, but those four iconic parks on the North Coast, Redwood National Park, Jedediah Smith State Park, Delmarte Coast Redwood State Park, and Prairie Creek Redwood State Park, were nearly two-thirds clear-cut before the land was protected. And as a result of that, those biological and infrastructural legacies are actively deteriorating. And Redwoods Rising is our effort to undo that damage and to set the forest towards a more resilient and more flourishing and vibrant future.
All right. Well, I think you had 45 seconds, so we might have to do a point deduction there. All right, Lathrop, your turn. Can you top Richard?
Well, I'll try to not over-repeat what he already said, but try to find a way to
sure. To
supplement what's already been said. I think part of the confusion folks sometimes have about Redwood Rising is that, say, the Redwoods League, Redwood National Park, and California State Parks have been partnering for decades on various restoration activities. But what makes this different is that we are reinvigorating that partnership by working much more closely together about the immediate needs and priorities of the three groups and how those priorities can come together into actions that benefit all three of our groups. We're finding better ways to work together to get these things done and find the strengths and weaknesses of each organization and seeing how the other organizations can help supplement those weaknesses and play to their strengths to get this work done in a more efficient manner than we've done in the past.
All right. That's a good tag teaming you two. All right. So that is broadly what we're going to be talking about today. Let's dive into some specifics and let's talk about kind of the background conditions that we find our parks in. So Lathrop, could you do a little bit of history and talk about, you know, most people when they think of Redwood State and National Parks, they think of, you know, Lady Bird Johnson Grove or Newton B. Drury, these big old growth redwoods. But a lot of the parks are not like that. Why is that the case?
Well, that's right. And, you know, when these parks were founded, of course, that was really the focus on buying up the iconic old growth stands that are so common throughout the North Coast region here. But we reached a point decades ago when we really started running out of old growth to buy up. And we also came to the realization long ago that it wasn't enough to just preserve these postage stamp type of groves, but we really had to think about preservation at the watershed scale. That we've had a lot of issues, which many of your readers probably know about, or listeners, where things happening, especially upstream from our iconic groves, have had a very big negative impact on the groves themselves. The 56 and 64 floods being two prime examples of that. And so in order to deal with that, we've bought up the land surrounding these parks. And in most cases, that was land that had already been logged by the timber companies. So we're now in the business of trying to repair those lands, not only to protect what's downstream, but also to provide better connectivity between the old growth forests and these three parks.
All right. So, Richard, you're standing at the border. You know, it's a pretty hard edge, let's say, between some old growth redwood to your left and some cut over former industrial timberlands to your right. Looking at the former industrial timberlands, what do they look like on the ground? Try to paint a picture for our listeners.
Sure. So the difference is going to be pretty stark. On the one hand, in the ancient forest, you have, you know, the first thing that you're going to see is the massive trees. But beyond that, you also see trees of all different sizes representing the entire potential age structure of a redwood tree, all the way from 0 to 2,000 years old and from an inch high to 350 feet high. And you'll also see the contrast in the spacing and the diversity of where those trees are and the individual species of those trees. In many timberlands, most of the stands are planted or are treated to promote the growth of a single species for future timber production. And so you'll see a very similar sort of homogenous cohort of trees, mostly the same size, mostly the same species, and very little diversity or abundance in the forest understory compared to the ancient forest.
All right. So when we're talking about forest diversity, why is it that we lack diversity in these former industrial timberlands? Or what is the diversity looking like? Richard, back to you.
We're lacking diversity in a few ways. The first way we're lacking it, as I mentioned, is in the diversity of the potential growth of these trees. When trees are managed to be harvested at 50 to 60 years, they can never achieve that biological potential. So we're losing that diversity. We're only ever seeing trees from 0 to 50 or 0 to 70 years old. We're also not seeing the diversity on the landscape level because oftentimes timber stands are planned for operational purposes rather than reflecting the landscape site. And so we're getting a much more homogenous footprint of stands. And the other way we're losing diversity, we're seeing a lack of diversity in industrial timberlands, is in all the rest of the community that makes a forest. When you're managing a land purely for the production of timber, that means that you're not managing it for those other factors and those other aspects of the forest. So those are oftentimes lost, either deliberately lost through site treatments, through the early period silvicultural treatments to establish the timber stand, or lost by inaction through the suppression and exclusion of fire over the long term.
All right. So Lathrop, correct me if I'm wrong. I'm thinking about kind of the stand composition. So the trees that make up the forest, the redwoods historically were dominated primarily by redwoods. Is that right? With other species mixed in there?
Yeah, so I think that's part of the diversity that Richard was getting at there, is that the timber companies were generally looking for either Douglas fir or redwood as their crop trees, but the redwood forests are generally much more diverse than that. And you know, there's a lot of variation depending on where you are. If you're down near in a floodplain of a large river, you know, that forest is going to look very different than a rocky ridge top, right? And the species composition that you're going to see is going to change throughout the range depending on those site-specific conditions. But so, for example, you know, western hemlock or grand fir, those are both pretty common tree species, just to name a few, that you would see within the redwood forest. But you don't tend to see those very often in an industrial forest because there's not as much timber value in that wood. So if they're there, they're kind of there by mistake or just because they happen to seed in naturally, not because that's something that the timber company is trying to grow.
And so something else that's incidental to all of this historic timber harvest are roads. Lathrop, can you talk a little bit about what the road conditions are like in a lot of the national and state parks?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, Tom, because, you know, this redwood rising is about a lot more than just forest restoration. It's really about ecosystem management and trying to restore the landscape in all its pieces. The big thing with the roads is we have a lot of legacy logging road that were put in there at various times of the past by the timber companies, and they are in disrepair, to say the least. A lot of those were put in there with little thought to what kind of effect they would have on our streams and our riparian areas and other things. And a lot of them are now thick with trees, so even if you wanted to drive them, you couldn't. But they are in the process of failing. We have landslides on coming in and burying streams off these roads. And in some cases, the streams are completely choked out by sediment, and there's no longer the habitat that was there for salmonids and other riparian species.
All right. So to see if I sum it up right. So we have kind of a lot of legacy problems here. We have a lack of kind of natural diversity that we would find in an unmanaged forest, or if we can use kind of the other parts, the old growth parts, as what we reference. You know, we're lacking in species diversity. We're lacking in different characteristics. We're lacking in structural complexity. And we have a history of roads that are continuing to bleed sediment into our rivers. And so this is broadly what Redwoods Rising is hoping to achieve, right? Or hoping to treat.
I think that's a really good start. There's another component that is worth mentioning, that there are some areas that are lacking trees. Generally, I think we see it the other way, that trees are able to encroach into prairies and other areas where there didn't used to be trees due to a lack of fire, which is something we want to address. But there's other areas that were redwood forest that have been logged and for various reasons have been converted into another vegetation type, such as an alder forest. And in those cases, we are looking at planting trees to restore the redwood forest. And also, in some cases, all the logs were removed from the stream decades ago. And because of that, the complexity of the stream and riparian habitat has been simplified, which is, as you can imagine, detrimental to fish and other species, aquatic species. So in some cases, we are looking at trying to reestablish the complexity within the streams by adding large woody debris back into these watercourses.
You're listening to the Eco News Report. I'm your host, Tom Wheeler, and I'm speaking with Lathrop Leonard and Richard Campbell about their collaborative groups, Redwood Rising. All right. So we talked a little bit about planting, and you're going to do some road restoration work. Let's get into the specifics on the forestry side. So what does restoration logging look like? So let's hit it over to Richard.
What does restoration logging look like? Well, I mean, it looks on a superficial level a lot like normal commercial logging. We use the same tools, a lot of the same people, and we use the same framework, the same operational and structural framework. What we do differently is we remove different trees. We're logging for a different purpose, both initially in terms of the trees that we select to keep and the trees that we select to move. And ultimately, we have a very different long-term goal, in that rather than growing a crop of trees to be harvested in the future, we're growing a crop of trees to become the ancient giants of the future forest.
So let's say that we have a stand that was aerially reseeded with Douglas fir. It is, you know, one of these, what we call like a dog hair thicket, where the number of trees per acre is drastically too high. So you're going to come in there with logging equipment, like a feller buncher, which is a ground-based machine which can cut down a tree and move to stack it. What is it going to look like before? What is it going to look like afterwards? Again, back to Richard.
Sure. So as you mentioned before, it's going to be, you know, an extremely dense forest. The trees will be very close together and very small. Specifically, you mentioned Doug fir, and that carries its own set of problems, because Douglas fir trees, being very shade intolerant, don't have the capacity to respond to thinning if they have been competing so strongly that they've lost a lot of their foliage and then their future photosynthetic capacity. So that specific example aside, what it would look like first, at least, as you mentioned, what they call a dog hair thicket. Those are really dense, small trees very close together. And what the operators will do, they would still remove a subset of those trees, usually somewhere between a quarter and a half, centering around a third of those trees. That would either be the very smallest trees in the stand or the trees that are competing directly with trees that we have identified to keep long into the future. And so the operators will fell those trees and will either lop and scatter the material around, or will sometimes remove some of that material from the site for redistribution or for merchandising to offset some of the cost of the operation. And so after, what you will see is a stand that still has most of its trees, but in which there's much more light penetrating into the forest floor, and a relatively thin carpet of what they call slash, that's the tops and branches of the trees that were felled.
And so the slash, your slash treatment is going to be to spread instead of pile and burn?
So there's going to be, you know, in 30 seconds or 15 second answers, you know, we're going to miss a lot. But we're going to be, you know, we're keeping all the tools at our disposal. We're going to be spreading slash and lobbing and scattering where it's appropriate. Where it's appropriate to pile and burn, we'll be doing that. And where it's appropriate to remove material from the site, we'll do that. And all of those things are really impossible to answer, you know, remotely on the phone, and they're really got to be, you know, the appropriate treatment for any one site has to be dictated by the conditions of the site and the context around it. So yes to everything, but the real sort of devil is going to be in the details of where those proportions are.
Sure. All right.
And so that's an important distinction that Richard is making there, and that, you know, there are certainly similarities to logging, but that's a big oversimplification. There's a lot of areas that we will not remove any biomass from, because either that biomass should stay there as habitat, or it's too difficult to get out without doing some kind of ecological harm to the area, and other variables can come into play. So if we determine that enough trees need to come down, that a lot of trees need to be cut so that we can continue to have, that we can maintain a healthy forest on the site, then we can evaluate what has to be cut down and how much of that that's being cut down is not needed on the site for ecological purposes such as coarse woody debris or even large wood in a stream restoration project. And if there is something left over that we can access without doing some kind of harm, then that opens the door for us to think about removing biomass to help pay for the restoration project.
So we have some idea that this works, that we are going to be able to hasten the creation of old growth characteristics. We're going to be able to release trees in the jargon so that they can grow bigger faster. How do we know this? What previous studies have been done in this area? And I'll throw that to Lathrop.
Well, there's quite a bit out there. There's, in fact, we have several publications within both California State Parks in the Del Norte Coast Redwood State Park area, as well as studies, peer-reviewed papers within the Redwood National Park area, where we've treated some areas and not treated other areas, and put in permanent monitoring plots within those areas to compare the long-term effects of our treatments. And we've and this has not only gone on within the parks, but within other ownerships as well in the Redwood region and the Pacific Northwest in general, that clearly shows not only are we able to grow bigger trees faster with these restoration treatments, but we're also make better habitat in the short term, such as by generating a more robust understory and maintaining the mycelia and fungi and wildlife species as well, seem to do better with our restoration treatments than if we did nothing at all.
And so, Lathrop, you also talked a couple moments ago or minutes ago now about being able to get some more complexity back on the landscape. So one thing that we typically associate with old growth conditions are coarse woody debris, these big, large downed trees, and standing dead trees, snags. So how are you going to be able to produce those through this project?
Yeah, so that's a big part of the equation, and there's a couple of things that we have to take into consideration for that. One, the amount of coarse woody debris that, or even snags that one would expect in an old growth forest depends on where you are, and especially depends on the fire return interval. You know, fires tend to burn up a lot of that coarse wood, so if you're there somewhere where you get a lot of fires, you would expect there to be less wood on the ground. The other thing is that the snags and coarse woody debris tend to be much more useful to a variety of species if it's large. So if we're in a stand where the trees that we're cutting down are all of a relatively small size, they may not be as useful for coarse wood or for snags. Not to say that we wouldn't leave some on site, but especially something like snag creation, that's a little bit of a more time-consuming to create. So when we treat an area like that, instead of making a lot of snags, we may more want to make sure to leave enough trees so that as they all grow bigger, then we're able to go back in for a treatment later on to make those snags, but wait till the tree's big enough to where it's useful habitat component before we either make a snag or cut it down to make coarse woody debris on the forest floor.
So something that has drawn some concern from EPIC members is some of the commercialization, some of the commercial aspects of this project. So the project has been described, and we're going to have environmental documents come out in the future, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But as described, says that you're going to sell off some of the wood that you log in the process of this restoration work, that you're not going to go out and log additionally to generate more money, but that you're going to take advantage of what is available and try to have some sort of a profit from that and funnel that back into restoration work. So some people are concerned who are EPIC members, and I hope that you can, Richard, I hope you can put their minds at ease, because, you know, I think that to start off with, the idea of logging within a national park is a bit scary, right? These are areas that we think of almost as if they're wilderness areas, you know, hands-off sort of management. But then to add the commercial element on top, particularly in this kind of political climate, and, you know, we won't name names, but in this political climate, there are concerns. I think that they are probably somewhat valid that this could be a bad precedent for other areas, or this could be abused. So tell us why we shouldn't be worried.
Well, I can't tell you why you shouldn't be worried, Tom, because I think it's very important to be worried and to make sure that we're all doing the right things for the right reasons. But what I can say is that the way that we come at this work is we think about the habitat structures and the ecological structures and the landscape systems that we're working to try to develop and that we're hoping to see into the future. And that sometimes the operations to create those structures result in some byproducts. And so when those byproducts meet all the needs of the site and sometimes even represent a potentially negative impact in terms of fuel loading to stay on site, only then do we consider removing those and ultimately selling them. So any timber products that are generated from the work are really the byproducts from the forest that we're trying to create.
So when you're evaluating a site, though, and when is too much biomass left? When is it too much, you know, wood left on the ground? How do you make that determination?
Sure. Well, we've got there's a big body of literature about forest fuel loading and various thresholds for various agencies and organizations that have risk tolerance. And so, again, it's going to be obviously a site-by-site issue. And a wetter, more protected site, we'd be able to tolerate more fuels than a much higher, drier, more potentially fire-prone site.
Are there fire-prone sites in the national park? I might not be familiar with all of it, but it seems like it's a pretty moist environment, generally speaking. So, and I've heard that historically fires were largely the result of Native American tribes and not from non-anthropogenic sources.
Sure. I mean, the parks do have a wide diversity, right? They go all the way from the ocean up to the ridgeline of the Bald Hills. And so there are, you know, there is that whole diversity of site between here and there. So there are definitely places in the landscape that are more prone to fire, and we can see some of those legacy structures both in the massive fire caves and scars and the redwood trees, as well as in some of the historic prairies that were established and ultimately maintained by fire. No question were the people that came here before the European Americans really, really determining what that fire frequency was and where those fires were. But that doesn't mean that fires can't happen and don't happen now. And with all of the, you know, the recreational pressure on these areas, you know, the fires are going to come from a place that we don't expect and we don't anticipate, and maybe we don't want for the protection of the resources.
All right.
I would just add to that within Redwood National and State Parks, there's also forests with little or no redwoods that were part of a very fire-dependent ecosystem, and that goes from the Knob Cone and Jeffrey Pine Forest to near pure stands of Douglas fir, and especially the Knob Cone and the Douglas fir are often prone to stand replacing fires, not these little creeping fires in the understory that we associate with redwoods, but very hot fires. So there's, again, just it's just a test to the diversity of ecosystems and fire regimes that the park experienced historically.
So we are just about out of time. I want to make sure that people know next steps. So this announcement of the formation of the collaborative has gotten some press. When are we going to be able to see some environmental documents so we can kind of know precisely what will be proposed?
So, yeah, we are in the process of working on those documents as we speak and putting our plans together. And so this summer, you would expect to be able to see some of the drafts of those as we do follow the scoping process. Richard, I don't know if you have the timelines in front of us that you can be more specific about that, but it should be coming quite soon.
All right. Well, when those come out, I'm sure that people would be interested in talking more about this. And so maybe we can have you guys back onto the show. Thank you so much for being on. I was just talking with Lathrop Leonard from State Parks, a great forester with that agency, and Richard Campbell, Forestry Program Manager with Save the Redwoods League. Thank you both for being on.
Thank you very much, Tom. And if any of the listeners have questions, they can visit our website, redwoodsrising.org.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I should have had a shout out for that website before, redwoodsrising.org. All right. Well, thanks to you both.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
This has been the Eco News Report. My name is Tom Wheeler, and I've been your host for the past half hour. I was just speaking with Lathrop Leonard with State Parks and Richard Campbell, Forestry Program Manager with Save the Redwoods League. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. If you'd like to replay this interview or share it with others, you can go to the archive programs page at khsu.org. Shows are also available now on your favorite podcast app. I subscribe on Podcast Addict, and I like to listen to the Eco News Report when I go on long drives. I suggest you do the same. The Eco News Report is produced at Humboldt State University in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Join us again next week right here for the Eco News Report.